This episode is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Radio Meters program.
Hello, you are tuned into Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the unceded territory of the Musqueam people at UBC. My name is Alirad Amari, and I'm joined by my co-host today, Gurman Gill. Each week on Research Review, we interview a researcher who is affiliated with the UBC community and discuss some of their latest work and findings and how they relate to broader issues in society.
Today we have Dr. Leah Karagata. She's on Research Review today. She is an associate professor and PhD program chair at the UBC School of Social Work. And we'll be talking about her research on lone mother-led families. It's a pleasure to have you on to the podcast today.
Thank you very much, Gurman. It's a pleasure to be here.
Could you start by telling us a bit about yourself and the work you do?
Sure. As you mentioned, I'm an associate prof in the School of Social Work here at UBC. My research has spanned perhaps about 15 years with a similar focus on single moms and their families and some of their difficult economic circumstances. Before coming to UBC in January, I was a professor at Wilfrid Laurier University in Ontario. And my research has generally been national in scope with research sites in Vancouver, in Toronto, and at times in St. John's, Newfoundland. So my research with single moms and my focus on single moms came about in the late 90s when there was a real change in how social assistance was allocated. And single parent-led families went from being able to get a special kind of higher level of benefit to being classed with everybody else who was on social assistance. And so there was a work requirement. Well, if you're a single person on welfare and there's a work requirement, you have many less obstacles to trying to get a job than if you're a single parent. And so we were really concerned that people were going to be left in a situation where they were going to have a very difficult time either finding adequate child care and maybe putting their kids at risk, or they were going to be unable to kind of complete the expectations of a work requirement, and they were going to continue on social assistance. So that's kind of the genesis of my research, and it's continued in a variety of ways with a number of different areas of focus since then.
Yeah, great. That's very important research. There's no question single mothers in Canada face quite a bit of adversity. I know in some of your papers you mentioned that about a third of single mothers have an income that's less than half the average. Could you speak to maybe some of the other adversities single mothers could face?
Well, one of the things that one has to think about is who single mothers are. And, you know, in Canada, we have a story that we often kind of hear that I think really kind of comes more from the United States than from here, is that single moms on social assistance are there because they just want to kind of not work and receive welfare. There's a whole kind of theme kind of that it's babies for welfare. So you have a baby and then you can get social assistance and you can just relax and not work. In Canada, the story of who single moms are is very different. About 75 or so percent of single mothers in Canada have actually left long-term relationships. And many of those have fled abuse, woman abuse, domestic violence, which obviously changes the complexion of who a single mother is and what the issues are quite significantly. One of the other kind of phenomena is to think a little bit more about who the single mother demographic is that many of them are already marginalized. They often are racialized women, indigenous women, new immigrants. It's a very common story to have a woman come with a partner who gets permanent residency status. She's here as part of the family reunification system, and she decides to leave him perhaps because of abuse, and she's at high level of risk because she doesn't have independent immigration status. She's dependent on him. So the who single mothers are is really important in terms of telling the story. They tend not to be white privileged women, or those aren't the single mothers that my work concerns themselves with. My work really focuses on racialized women, on women who are carrying probably what one might think of as a triple threat. they're single mothers, they're poor, and they have some other aspect of kind of that marginalizes them, either racialized or indigenous status, or they're new immigrants without status. So they're really at risk in a number of ways, which obviously makes it much harder for them to get jobs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I understand that intersectionality plays a large role in your research. You mentioned how have a lot of focus on racialized women. Is speaking and writing English like a requirement for your study participants? Because I guess that would be a significant portion of single mothers, and it'd be interesting to see if they like face an additional language barrier and what that would entail.
Oh, interesting question. So we do conduct our interviews in English. We have considered many, many times doing kind of translation, but it's complicated and costly, as you can imagine. People certainly don't need to be able to write in English, but they do have to be able to have kind of a functional level of English. But we haven't actually found that there were very many people who were interested in participating in our research who didn't have some level of kind of functional English, and we're prepared to kind of really muddle through. So we actually haven't had too much of an issue there. And we've focused on various kinds of things. That first large study I was telling you about was really focused on transitions between work and welfare. What happens to people under those new welfare rules? Could they get work? And if they did get work, was it sustainable? And I don't want to interrupt because I think you're about to ask another question, but if I could just tell you one little short vignette about one of the women in that situation. If that would be okay. So there was a woman, and we'll call her Rose. Everybody chooses a pseudonym for the research, who had two children, 3 and 5. And she was very committed to trying to get a job, absolutely committed. She didn't want to raise her kids on social assistance. And so she managed to get a job well above minimum wage, paying almost $18 an hour. And she managed to get subsidized daycare for both her kids. The trick was, though, that the subsidized daycare were in two different daycare spots. And she would leave home at 6 o'clock in the morning, bundling these kids up. She's in Ontario, where there's significant winter, bundling the kids up. And she'd have to get on a bus with both little kids, pushing the stroller through the snow, get off the bus to drop child number one off at daycare number one, catch another bus, rush to the next daycare, drop that child off, and that was the younger kid who cried and missed her mom, and then get on yet another bus to get to her office by 8:30. And as you can imagine, by the time she got to her office at 8:30, she was exhausted. Mm-hmm. And then the stress would come at the end of the day where she had to do all of that in reverse, and many daycares charge a very, very hefty fine if you arrive later than 6 o'clock, sometimes as much as $1 a minute. So she would be under tremendous stress to leave work by 4:30 and do all of these pickups in reverse and get home at 6:30 or 7 with the kids, exhausted and having had no time with her kids. And by the end of about 3 or 4 months, she found that she had to quit because she just couldn't sustain it. So it really tells an important story about the importance of kind of subsidized childcare that actually works for women who are trying to be in the workplace, and recognizing that in some cases it's not reasonable that somebody have a work expectation when they've got two preschool kids. So it's one of those little stories that sticks with me over many, many years, because here was somebody who really wanted to be in the labor market and all of the structures didn't support that.
Yeah, definitely. I guess that would also be a case for some larger companies having childcare within their building. Yeah, I know, obviously. Like some hospitals do that.
Yeah, that would obviously make all the difference in the world.
We'll be back here on Research Review after one short message.
Celebrating human ingenuity, resilience, and grit. Tell a Story Hive's Game Changers Documentary Edition is here. Calling all local emerging filmmakers in BC and Alberta, StoryHive is offering 30 grants of $20,000 each to capture stories of local game changers that are making their community a better place. Send in your application to storyhive.com/apply by November 10th. If you have a story to share, we want to hear from you.
You're listening to Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM.
And you mentioned some of the struggles, like being able to commute when it comes to women in major cities like Toronto or Vancouver, St. John's. How do those challenges single mothers face maybe differ from small towns to major cities?
Well, I mean, obviously, at least there are transportation systems here. We may not always love waiting for a bus, but at least there's a bus. Whereas in rural communities, there may be no transportation at all. And if you're trying to kind of manage having a car on social assistance, you're going to really have no money left. I mean, I think the real issue is a story about poverty. It's a story about the fact that there really is not enough money allocated under our current social assistance systems anywhere in the country that provide enough for somebody who, to sustain a family. And there are very few effective incentives for people to get off social assistance into the labor market. Various programs across the country offer a variety of kinds of training programs for people on social assistance. But most often, I mean, one of the ones that's offered in Ontario is Microsoft Skills. So, you know, you're a student, just about finished your degree. Tell me how employable you'll be because you know how to use Microsoft Office. There aren't so many jobs that are just looking for that. So we waste money training people for jobs that are useless. And one of the very significant training programs offered to women on social assistance is being a personal support worker. And those jobs, by their very nature, require people at meal times and bedtime. So if you're a single mom, that's the time when you're least likely to be able to actually do your work. So we're not very effective at enabling people to actually get off social assistance because they've been able to get the kind of training that they need. In the time when I was doing that initial study on welfare to work, the only province in Canada that allowed a single mom to go back to university was New Zealand. It allowed a woman to be on social assistance and pursue a university degree, which I hope it will be your experience, but that tends to get people jobs much more than a program in Microsoft Office.
Yeah, I guess that's a bit of a problem with some of the work to welfare problems or workfare programs. A lot of the jobs they do employ are pretty poor, I would assume, like jobs that pretty much anyone can do and they don't pay very well. There's no chance for growth. And I would also assume that the hours are terrible. There'd be lots of shift work, on-call work, night shifts, just stuff that's impractical for a single mother to do.
Yeah, that's exactly the story, for sure. And then that places an extraordinary burden on the children. I have a current Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council grant that looks at what we're describing as youth provisioning. So it's the work that kids do in low-income families to support their families. And this is really unacknowledged both by the educational system and by the welfare system. That if you've got a couple of kids in a variety of ages and you're a single mother and whether you're working or not, those kids pick up a kind of burden that most kids in most families don't. They may work part-time and hand money over to their mother in order to help kind of carry the family's living costs. They may have to do all of the sibling child care because the mother can't afford to pay for that. They may have many, many more household care responsibilities. They may have to do all of the kind of cleaning and shopping and those kinds of things because the mother is working. So the burden on the kids is very significant, and sometimes that's at the cost of their schooling. It may mean that they can't ever participate in some extracurricular activity at school because they're going to get home to look after a younger sibling, or they have family work that they have to do. One of the things that we know is so true for kids in non-English-speaking families is that they do endless translation. And sometimes that's very difficult for a child because they may be translating medical and legal information that kids really shouldn't be having to worry about. And yet they're in a place where they're actually learning about things that their adult single mom is worrying about and concerned about, and they're the translator. So those place extraordinary burdens on kids and these families, and that too is also quite unacknowledged.
Yeah, I would assume that with all those additional burdens, it would be even harder for those sorts of children to escape poverty.
Absolutely. We're setting it up. It's exactly the point, Carmen, that what ends up happening is that the kids don't focus on school. It's very difficult for them to really kind of make that a priority when they have the demands that they have at home. And that's to say nothing of the deficits that are created in terms of nutrition, because the amount of money that somebody's getting on social assistance doesn't allow somebody to buy fresh fruit and vegetables, for example. And we have lots of stories about people who talk about the fact that they can afford fresh fruit and vegetables only once a month when the welfare check comes in. And then for the rest of the time, they buy cheap carbs.
Do you think there's a bit of a cycle of poverty when it comes to single mother-led families? Do a lot of the people you have in your studies also come from single mother-led families?
It really depends. I kind of resist the idea. There's a whole kind of notion that poverty breeds poverty. And I mean, there clearly is a factor there in that if one has the kinds of deficits and disadvantages that we've just been talking about, it's going to be harder to excel. But there's certainly lots of stories of resilience, which is another area that I've kind of focused my research on, where people do really overcome extraordinary odds. And resilience has often been talked about as a kind of psychological factor, an individual psychological factor. But more recent research on resilience really looks at it as supports that come from all kinds of different places. And so sometimes it's a mentor or somebody, a teacher at a school, for example, who really steps up and acts as a mentor for somebody who's growing up in a low-income, single-mom-led family, and actually supports that person to go on to do well at school. So yes, I think there's a real factor of people who are poor being trapped in the kind of cycle of poverty, but there are also some really nice illustrations of people who can, you know, both get some support from a variety of kinds of places and move out of those kinds of situations.
Yeah, let's talk a bit more about resilience, because I know a lot of your research focuses on that. Could you maybe speak to the differences between resilience and, say, coping?
There's a zillion. You could probably find a thousand papers on the differences. I'm not really sure that there are very fine gradations of some people say that coping is just kind of enduring everyday life. Resilience has to kind of be some achievement where you move out of your difficult circumstance. I'm not sure that really matters or counts. I think that lots of people demonstrate resilience just by coping. It depends really on what you're coping with. If you're coping with just an extraordinary level of burden at every front, and you're coping with that, well, I would suggest that that person is resilient. So my research doesn't kind of try to assess so much who's resilient, but look at what kinds of things support resilience. And one of the interesting findings that we identified that doesn't show up very often in the literature is that among single moms, one of the important sources of resilience that really supported people's resilience were feminist non-governmental organizations that had a particular feminist orientation. And those were very significant, partly because the workers in those organizations understood their work and their roles differently. And that was quite powerful. Many, many women who we interviewed talked about the fact that when they actually encountered such an organization, were hooked up with a shelter that was had a feminist orientation, or a community neighborhood house that had a strong feminist orientation, the workers there went above and beyond the call. They became guides, they became mentors, they became helpers. There's a story of a woman who was fleeing abuse, and her abusive partner found her and the children, and she was able to contact this worker after hours by her phone her cell phone, which the worker had given her the number, and the worker, you know, zoomed out kind of late in the evening to rescue this woman and her kids, and then drove her more than 100 kilometers to another shelter in another city so that she wouldn't be found. Well, that isn't the kind of work that most people think, you know, in your 9-to-5 office that you're going to do. But the women really found that those kinds of supports, where people really cared about them, were huge in making a real difference. And this woman in that little vignette went on to stay in that other community and got a job, and it was a less expensive community than the big city she'd been living in. And so she was able to get off social assistance. And so that, you know, was a really lovely illustration of resilience, that really the key moment in it was the tremendous support she had from that one worker that made a real difference in that woman's life.
Yeah, I feel like genuine support is a big factor in manifesting resilience in people.
Yeah, for sure. And it can be supportive of a variety of kinds. Another illustration from my work is a single mom who had always dreamed in her home country of becoming an engineer. And it was often the story, she ended up marrying somebody who was an abuser, and they had a couple of kids. She came to Canada with him, and one of her children had a disability, and the abusive ex left at that moment, which was a mixed blessing because he was also a good financial provider. But her dream of becoming an engineer kind of went south. But what happened was that she was telling this story, and she was telling this story on a radio interview that she and I were both at, and someone who is an engineer heard the story and called me after, found my email, because I was an academic and he could find my email, and contacted me and said, I'm willing to pay for her to go to engineering school if she's still interested. And she's just graduated this past year. So sometimes support comes in a variety of kinds of ways, but it's often, you know, personal, and that somebody really kind of is prepared to put themselves out, and that makes an enormous difference for somebody.
We'll be back here on Research Review after one short message.
Looking to get a reliable and affordable used bike? Need a repair or service to your current ride?
Come to the Bike Kitchen, UBC's full-service community bike shop, located in room 36 of the UBC Life building. Our hours are Monday to Friday, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m.
If you buy a bike from us, bring it back when you're done using it, and we'll give you half of your money back, as long as you took care of it. If it needs repairs, we'll split the cost with you.
Yep, you heard us right. We'll give you crisp dollar bills for half the original price of any used bike that you buy from us, minus the cost of repairs.
For more information about our buyback policy and to stay up to date on any COVID-19 inspired changes, find us online at thebikekitchen.com.
You're listening to Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM.
Yeah. You brought up that example of personal charity, and I believe, like, in the U.S., that's a huge case for an alternative to the whole welfare state that they are saying that there is. Like, this whole idea of, like, welfare queens and being, like, just abusing the welfare system. They sort of have the idea that they can reduce the welfare system and they can depend on the personal charity of others to fix the situation. I would assume that's not practical at all, though.
Well, practical or not, it denies justice. You know, it's interesting, this fall I'm teaching a master's course on social justice. And so I've been thinking a lot about what justice is and how we kind of think about justice. And, you know, personal charity, I mean, you know, it's nice. I mean, that engineer who came along, that's a lovely thing. But if this woman had wanted to become an engineer, wouldn't it be in our collective interest to have had all of us support her through our welfare system to go back to school to become an engineer? She's going to be off the system forever. She's going to be much kind of better support and mentor and exemplar for her kids. So the whole notion of kind of prisoner charity denies that idea of justice, that we have some obligations to each other and that it's in our collective interests for us all to do well. There are really interesting studies out of Scandinavian countries where there's much more equality across the economic spectrum, where everybody is happier, everybody has better health outcomes, not just the people who are at the low end. So societies that are more equal tend to be more productive, happier, and where everybody is healthier. So I think that's a big argument for social justice and against the kind of personal charity model.
Yeah. What particularly does Scandinavia do that we could do better?
Well, I don't think they trap anybody on $1,000 a month on social assistance. There are just a wide range of social welfare programs. There's lots of public housing. In Sweden, this was now many, many years ago, but in Sweden, when they first began to develop a homelessness problem, they assessed the situation and made a commitment to build 1 million public housing units over a 10-year period of time. And unlike what we do politically, they signed a multi-party agreement so that even if there was a federal election and a party change, that all of the parties would agree to continue. And so really they dealt with their homelessness problem in a very, very effective way. We would never do anything like that. Ours are kind of hit and miss. We have somebody get into government and say, yes, yes, let's build some public housing. And then, you know, there's a change of government and the plan is abandoned, or we never do quite enough. So I think it's really looking at poverty and poverty-related issues across a big spectrum and making a real public commitment. And part of the problem with being right next door to the United States is that so many of those ideas from the United States filter up, so that we do have this kind of notion that people who are on welfare are abusing the system, that they're, you know, kind of lining up at the beer store, they're wasting their public money, they're ne'er-do-wells, rather than really looking at who's on social assistance and trying to figure out ways that we can really support them to do well on that system or to move out of that system and into the labor market. And certainly among the women that I've interviewed, almost all of them would much prefer to be working. They just need to be working, as you mentioned earlier, in jobs that provide enough for their families and that are sustainable, unlike that story I told you about Rose and her two kids, which was just completely unsustainable.
Yeah, you mentioned homelessness, and my first thought came to right here in Vancouver, where housing is just a massive problem. What sort of problems do single mothers have in finding subsidized housing right here in Vancouver?
Well, it's horrible. I mean, the amount of subsidized housing is so small, and rents are so high that people end up living in very, very difficult housing circumstances, sharing with people that they don't know. And especially if you've got kids, the stress of kind of trying to manage your kids in situations where they need to be quiet all the time creates enormous stress. Or people end up living in very unsafe housing situations, and that impacts obviously the safety of their kids. Somebody who I just interviewed talked about the fact that she never lets her kids play outside because there's no safe place for that to happen. And so if you think about kind of what happens to the life of those children and their level of physical activity, it's very constrained. And obviously that's going to be an impact, have a long-term impact on them.
Are there any subsidized housing developments in Vancouver that target single mothers in particular?
There are. There's a housing cooperative, in fact, that not single mothers necessarily, but women and families, yes. But I think there's obviously a need for more. And then I think also you need to kind of really think about, do we want to create a kind of ghetto of a single mother's housing complex? Probably not. But I think that there needs to be more subsidized housing generally, because it's not just single mothers, but many, many people who are low income in Vancouver. As somebody who moved from Ontario and Toronto, where housing is actually as staggered at the cost of housing here. So it's beyond what's possible for many, many people. And if you think about people who then get into the labor market and have a job at the kind of low economic end, they're still not going to be able to afford an adequate place to live unless they start to move way far out into the suburbs, and then they're going to have commute times and those kinds of challenges. And if you're a single parent again, what are you going to do around childcare?
Right, definitely. Like I volunteer at a community health clinic where we try to assess the social determinants of health, and a lot of the people at the clinic struggle with finding adequate housing, and we try to help them out with like BC housing applications, but those are like years long, and like you have to check in every 6 months or they'll take you off the list, and just the amount of paperwork, I couldn't even figure it out. I don't know how someone with much less support would be able to figure that system out.
And you wonder when you encounter systems like that, that's a great illustration. Is the goal of the system to actually get people off the list? Because if you fail to check in, you're off the list. And, you know, there are a million illustrations like that all through our social welfare system, where there are these bars and tricks that almost that you have to kind of maintain or you get kind of or you lose benefits. And those are one of the challenges. In Ontario, one of the things that used to happen to single mothers is that they had to go and, if you've got kids in school, you actually had to go and get the principal to write a letter every 6 months, once a term, to confirm that your children were attending school. Well, if you don't attend school for anybody, then, you know, there's going to be kind of some contact from the school board if you've got school-age kids. Why is it that people on welfare have this extra obligation of having to go and beg a principal to write a letter and say, I'm on social assistance, could you please write a letter confirming my kids go to school? And if they don't do that, then they lose their benefits. And it's just another illustration of these hoops that are set up to just be unnecessarily trapping of people.
Yeah, that seems very scary. Like the whole idea of the whole welfare system is supposed to be this idea that we're supposed to be helping people and they're supposed to be getting off welfare for genuine reasons, not just because they failed some stupid test.
Yes, although I mean, I love your assumption and I love the values expressed by it that we're supposed to be helping people. But I think we have such an ambivalence about whether we really mean to help people or we really mean to give them so little that they get desperate and try to get off some other way. And we trap people. It's probably a little bit politically tricky to talk about this, but we trap people in lying to the system and in cheating, because we know that we don't give people enough money to live on. And you have to declare if you receive a gift, and then that can be partially clawed back from your welfare payment. So if somebody gets some groceries given to them by a neighbor or a friend or a parent, do they declare that as part of their income? No, of course not, because they need those desperately. But they're also conscious of the fact that if they don't declare it, in a certain sense, they're skirting the rules. And we pay people honoraria for doing interviews, and it's just a small amount. It's to recognize their time as being valuable. But we always do that in either cash or a gift card, because we don't want people to have to declare that income and get it clawed back off their welfare check. So we put people in real binds where we're the system, in a certain sense, is so mean-spirited, if you will, that people are kind of forced to feel like they're kind of on the edge of being a cheat. So I don't know whether we really want the welfare system, whether the welfare system is genuinely meant to help, or it's meant to ensure that we don't have people starving to death on the street so that we can feel good about ourselves, which is maybe a harsh judgment. But
we'll be back here on Research Review after one short message.
Do you like to stare out of the window on long car rides thinking about your feelings? Do you like to watch the trees sway with the wind to the gentle sounds of an acoustic guitar? Then Feeling Sounds is the radio show for you. Tune in to CITR 101.9 FM on Thursdays at 4 p.m. for some soft indie music.
Sit on the carpet, sipping on chamomile, tell me a day.
You're listening to Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM.
Yeah, as we talked about a bit earlier, I know lots of countries, including Canada, have this whole work for welfare system. And for some reason, it's getting even more popular outside of North America. I know Australia has some sort of system now, and the UK, I believe. Why is it that you think this whole idea is becoming more popular?
Well, I don't actually think there's anything wrong with the idea of trying to encourage people into the labor market. It's a question of whether you're trying to encourage them into the labor market or you've got a kind of stick to whip them into the labor market. And I think the problem with most work for welfare programs, and there's lots of research that demonstrates this, is that the places that do it with encouragement, the carrot rather than the stick, do a way better job of it. Because first of all, you're going to meet with somebody, you're going to assess what it will take to get them into the labor market, the kinds of job training that they need to get a sustainable job, and then you're going to kind of facilitate that. Whereas the stick approach is just a threat that if you don't get into the labor market, you're going to get kicked off assistance. And so maybe they will get into the labor market, but chances are they're going to get into the labor market like the Rose story I already talked about, where they get into the labor market and then they're back on social assistance again because it wasn't sustainable. So I think the real problem with work for welfare programs, as they mostly are constituted, is that they use the stick. Get off social assistance or we're going to cut you off, rather than thinking about how it is that we can really support somebody to get on to, into the labor market. But then we also kind of have to take up the labor market challenge, which is that if there are only so many jobs that people are going to be able to get in the labor market, that will be sustainable. And so how do we think about our world of work in a different way so that we create jobs that actually can be sustainable and that pay adequately?
Yeah. You mentioned earlier that education is a big way of making sure that we can get higher income jobs and hopefully more sustainable jobs. Are there a lot of programs out there that have welfare under the condition that you're in some sort of education program, for example, like a trades program?
Well, very few welfare programs across the country will allow somebody to do any kind of post-secondary while they're on social assistance. So we need tradespeople in Canada desperately, and there are good jobs and they pay well, so why don't we let people on social assistance be training to be electricians and plumbers and welders? Those are good jobs, but we don't enable people to do those programs while they're on assistance. So you can get a student loan and go off of assistance, but again, if you're a single parent, that's a very dicey situation because you're afraid to lose your benefits. And one of the benefits that attaches to social assistance that people rely on very heavily is the drug and dental and vision care benefits that they get because they're on welfare. And so they're hesitant, even if they can get enough on a student loan to cover their housing costs, which is obviously tricky, they're afraid to lose those other benefits.
Yeah. I would assume those problems would be further exemplified in the U.S., where the student loan market's predatory, to say the least, and healthcare is awful. You can rack up hundreds of thousands in medical debt for something you had no control over. And I would assume that overcoming all that would be exponentially more difficult than here in Canada.
Yeah, for sure. I think any problem that we have in Canada is exponentially much, much worse if you're in the United States and you're poor. It's not a good country to be poor in. And, you know, we're so proud of our healthcare system, and it generally is a good healthcare system, and people are covered. But, you know, if you go to the doctor, I often say, if you go to the doctor, doctors can do two things. They can diagnose, but then in terms of treatment, they can prescribe drugs, or they can do surgery. Well, if you need surgery, you're good because the hospitals are covered here. But if you need a prescription, you're not covered other than the kind of limited care, the coverage that's provided. And in BC, we do slightly better than in many provinces in the country, but in lots of provinces, there's no provincial coverage for drugs, which is why part of the election platform this year, federal election platform, is a PharmaCare program, because that would make a big difference to lots of low-income Canadians.
Yeah, and I know some of the subsidized PharmaCare in BC is very particular about what medications they will subsidize.
Yes, exactly, yeah. So, yeah. And there are lots of, you know, if you've got one of the women that I interviewed has a daughter with major healthcare problems, and she would have been able to be treated with a drug that is not typically covered And so you can do a special application process for coverage, and it was denied. So here's a situation where a kid in a low-income family isn't getting the kind of drug that might make a huge difference in her life, whereas if she was in an affluent family, that would be an issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one question I had during our, while we were talking, was what sort of outcome measures can we use to assess the well-being of single mother-led families? Because I assume it's a very complex and multifaceted issue.
For sure. And, you know, there are a variety of kinds of scales, etc. But one of the things that I'll often say, because it comes up often as a question, is to just ask people. Because people can assess their own well-being. And the metrics and kind of scales assume that there's kind of a way of doing a gradation that applies to everybody. And I've seen some women in situations that I would find very, very challenging. One woman I can think of has a daughter with a disability, and she lives on in a second floor apartment without no elevator in the building. And she carries her daughter up and down this large, long flight of stairs. And I would find that almost intolerable. But she likes where she lives, and she's found some part-time work that fits with her daughter's programs, and she assesses her quality of life as being very good now. And she's somebody who I've been interviewing for a number of years, and I've seen real, speaking of resilience, seeing a real change in her quality of life. So, you know, if we were to do some kind of standard scale, she probably, given the many, many obstacles she deals with, she would not look like somebody who has a satisfactory, if you will, quality of life. And yet she reports otherwise. So I think one of the best ways of assessing that is really to ask people, because they know what they need. They know what's a problem for them. And it's very individual. Different people like different things and can put up with different things, or find other things that are unbelievable barriers that someone else might think, well, that's not such a big deal. So I'm a big favor of qualitative work, because people can tell their own stories.
Yeah, I know in research there's a big push to quantify those sorts of things, but I don't understand how you could quantify a simple question like, how are you doing?
Yeah, exactly. I think that's the critical thing. And that's how, pretty much how I started every interview I do, is how are you doing? What's going on in your life? And it's extraordinary how much people want to tell their stories. We have women who call us and say, I'm going to move, but I don't want you to miss me. So, you know, here's a contact number for a friend of mine, so that if you try me and you can't get me, call her and she'll know where I am. Because people are very keen to be able to kind of feel like their stories are being told.
Yeah. We're about to wrap up here, but one last question I had was, what sort of large-scale policy changes could be implemented to improve the welfare of single mothers? Because I know election's coming up. What sort of policies do you think should be implemented?
Well, at a federal level, thinking about the election, I mean, very, very significant commitments to the child care program that we've been promised in Canada for 20-plus years, 30-plus years. So that's a federal thing that could happen. And a significant amount of money going into subsidized housing, both nonprofit and public housing. And then money, you know, the federal government transfers money through a tax program, or tax points rather, to the provinces, earmarking some of that very specifically for employment training, and a real push with the provinces to increase the amount of money that people get on social assistance. You know, BC has a poverty reduction program. It's a great name. I don't know how much it's really doing in terms of on the ground moving people out of poverty. And that's what we really need to think about. I mean, the child care subsidies made a big difference in terms of the lives of many, many people in Canada, many single parents or parents generally. But we need to do more of that. But as we talked about, housing costs are huge, and the amount of benefits that people get on social assistance are inadequate, and we need to really find ways to kind of support people moving into the labor market in ways that are sustainable.
Yeah, that's a good summary of what we could be doing. And good way to wrap up our podcast. Thank you for coming on today, and thank you so much for the work you do. I think it's very important.
Thank you very much for your great interview, Jeremy. Thank you.
Thank you.
Take care.
This concludes Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM. And the guest on today's show was Dr. Leah Cargata, an associate professor and PhD program chair at UBC School of Social Work.